Well, I can tell that everybody here grew up in the Midwest. I mean, yeah, nobody here is intimidated by the threat of snow. Welcome. Y'all come up. We got lots of seats, so please do find a place to sit down. And we're gonna have an interesting one. We promise we'll let people out by 4 o'clock. They tell us that's gonna be kind of when the town panics and closes down. Thank you all for coming. We're delighted to have you here. This is a very important session, which is part of the trying to fill out the intellectual story around the defense budget and the QDR that's been released. And we're going to talk about a dimension that normally doesn't get a lot of attention, and that's the industrial base. I think the most important decision we made to win the Cold War was a decision that we made 40 years before the start of the Cold War. And that was when we decided as a nation that we were going to be building military aircraft in the private sector, not in arsenals. Prior to that time, we'd been largely building, equipping and providing the kit for military forces in an arsenal-based system. And we all know, I mean, arsenals have an appropriate role, but when you're looking to really harness the creativity and energy that comes really with the profit-seeking sector, we did that. We made this brilliant decision, I think, when we harnessed the energy of the free enterprise system to national security. And we did that 40 years before the Cold War. Now, we didn't win the Cold War because we put a larger military force in the field. We had to put a military force in the field that would offset the superior quantities in the Warsaw Pact with superior quality. And that came with having these partners in the private sector that gave us that and helped us design it. So it's in every sense of the world, it's the fifth service, or sixth if we count the Coast Guard, which I want to count. The sixth service that actually made it possible for us to win the Cold War, and every day makes us possible for us to succeed in the battlefield. Now, the problem is we treat this sixth service as the neglected stepson of a family and give it the least amount of attention when we're making resource decisions in the department. And I will plead guilty. That certainly was what I did when I was a comptroller. And of course, that was before I became a virgin, and when I was the deputy secretary, we did not pay any systematic attention to the role that the private sector played as an indispensable partner. And I learned painfully about two-thirds of the way through my time when I was the deputy that we had, an industrial base that was in crisis, and we needed to spend some time about it. I rather think we're coming to that point again, and we're going to have to spend some energy and time thinking about this. Now, we're fortunate to have Brett with us this morning. He chose this over staying at home with sick children. Now, I'm not sure which means is the worst problem that he's working with, but we're glad that he did choose to come with us and that he's going to share some of his thoughts. And then we've got a worthy panel. I mean, it looks like an old Dutch master's print with a bunch of grumpy white guys sitting around one side of a table, doesn't it? Huh? But I have a feeling it'll be better. And these are the best intellects that we have that can bring to bear cross-cutting perspectives on a shared problem. So it's going to be an exciting morning. We're glad you're here. Brett, let's get started with you. Unless, David, do you have anything that you want to say, Administrator? Let's just get started. Brett, you start the way. But thanks. Let's welcome Brett Lambert to be with us here.
Thanks. It's a nice introduction. It's the best one I've had in a few months. Usually they say, who's that guy in the back row when I get introduced? But I wanted to start by saying just a couple of overall general things that I'm new to the building. And I was reminded by a friend of mine who took a job at a big foundation some time ago and a lot of you in this room know that individual, but he was told by the foundation director that in his new position, he would never again get a sincere compliment or a bad meal. And what I've learned is that I'm a little bit worried about introductions because I get nice compliments, but I can't accept the meal anymore. So anyway, I left a dollar back by the table, and these guys saw me for the coffee. But I want to thank Dr. Hamery, not just for his time this morning, but over the years being a true mentor to me and I think most of the people up here at this table. I've really valued, and hopefully the building will benefit from your willingness, sir, to in essence, mentor and share your experiences and insight. And I know I'm not the only one here. I'm looking around the room, and I can see about half of you have benefited from his generosity. And David, it's an impressive room, so I appreciate everyone who came out. My grandfather used to say that the value of a man was when the local farmers met for coffee and you weren't there, they would still say nice things about you. And I assure you, we say nice things about you when we're having coffee. That said, I'm as a Midwesterner that you took under your wings, and being from Western Kansas, I still want to try to convince you that South Dakota is part of the East Coast establishment. So, just so you know. But thanks for everyone who braved the weather forecast to come out this morning. The good news is that I think this will be the last meeting of your day, and then everyone can go home. I came from the Pentagon, plan to go back to the Pentagon, but I realized as I was going there this morning that I don't have a good understanding of whether we've insourced or outsourced the snow removal. So I'm trying to figure that out before I head back. That's really meant for you, Alan, the insourcing, outsourcing line there. We're trying to get some clarification. But I also want to thank David for setting this up and CSIS. It's a great topic. It's an incredible panel. And I went through the list of those that were scheduled to show up, and I have to say I'm very humbled by this. I feel like I'm coming home. My first job in Washington, D.C. was actually in this building. When I was a freshman at Kansas State, I applied for a position or a stint at Georgetown University, but we didn't have money, and so I also applied for a stipend, and I'm happy to report that both Georgetown and CSIS were more than generous, and so even though my mom didn't know I did it, I arrived here, and so I spent my first internship in Washington under the famous Bill Taylor, Colonel Taylor, and afternoons with Senator Robert Dole when he was on the Finance Committee. So, yes, I'm that old. That's how long ago it will be since I first came here. So I appreciate being back. It's I've been around CSIS for almost 20 years now in different forums, and it's just a wonderful institution. It's given so much to our nation. And so much of the interaction that we're going to have here today would not be possible without the good offices of CSIS. So I thank Dr. Hamery and David for setting this up. Now, I've only been in the department for a few months, so I get a little nervous when I speak publicly because I'm told to stay away from, it's more self-regulating at this point than it is anything else. I'm trying to bring to the department a new understanding of the industrial base and industrial capacity. I'm stepping on a lot of toes, which I did in my previous life in industry. I find the difference is that these toes tend to be heavily armed and very dominating in many ways. So that's one issue. Not to mention that when I accepted the position, I was asked that one of the things we want you to do is think outside the box. Think about industrial policy, about the industrial base. We really need to get a handle on that. And in the first few months, it's taken me some time to realize that my box has five sides and a lid. So this is more complicated than I thought it was going to be. So my transition has been interesting from a personal perspective. As many of you know, in my life in the private sector, I spent a lot of time questioning the skills, the capabilities, and frankly, the intelligence of what the government was doing. I'm happy to report that I spend now more time defending the skills, capabilities, and the intelligence of what we're doing in government. So it's a different dynamic. And I'll get specifically to some other experiences that I've had in the building that I think are actually quite positive, both for industry and the overall security of the country. I was asked today to talk specifically about industrial policy in the context of the QDR. So that's where I'm going to focus and how it was pulled, the threads were pulled through the QDR. And I'll try to, as best I can, to answer specific questions about programs. But I'd like to set more of a tone in the overall context. And I want to start by saying I can't say enough about my contemporaries and new colleagues in the building, and particularly those that really pushed in the QDR for industrial policy to be a high priority. Bottom line is we wouldn't be having this meeting today without the acknowledgement of Secretary Flournoy, my boss, Dr. Carter, the Secretary himself, and Deputy Secretary Lynn, that industrial policy and industrial-based issues are serious and concerning issues. They all get it. And for those of you that think this is lip service, I can assure you it is not. One of my first taskings when I joined the department was to lead the effort in drafting the industrial policy and industrial-based language in the QDR. This is an important distinction as a political appointee. It hasn't happened in some time. It's important to realize this was not being pushed up from me. This was being pushed down to me. And all of those in the room here who have served understand and recognize the difference of that imperative. The leadership was very serious, very committed to understanding, sometimes at 2 in the morning, which was a little too serious for my taste, but for getting clarification and insight into what are the issues that we need and the challenges we need to address in the coming years. And I can't say enough about the fact that when I took this position, I was warned about the institutional barriers within the department. I was warned about fiefdoms. All of that melted away. And I can't say enough about the work the group in the policy shop and Secretary Flournoy, just the access they gave us, the interaction we had. It is a true tribute to the policy community. And frankly, the QDR experience has to date been one of, if not the most positive experiences I've felt, where my organization was able to move the ball forward for the warfighter, the taxpayer, and our partners in industry. I can't say enough about the often criticized but too rarely recognized policy organization within the Pentagon. And I think it's also important to put the QDR in a bit of common sense perspective, going back to my Kansas roots. No documents can answer all the questions or all the musings of all the people. If it could, I would suggest that we rebrand it Nostradamus Chronicles and guarantee results in 2020, sell it for $14.95, and try to pay down the debt. It just doesn't happen. It's a tool and an exercise. I'm a climber, and over the years I've learned the hard way that it's necessary to exercise before you climb. The exercise doesn't climb the mountain, but you can't climb the mountain without exercise. The QDR is an exercise that informs, that guides, and shapes our vision as a department, but it alone doesn't get us to the summit. It's a tool, and for the first time in a long time, I personally believe it's not only recognized the reality, but embraced in terms of industrial policy, and again, my thanks go out to those in the department who asked for our input. When I was first hired, Dr. Carter relayed to me a story that Secretary Gates told him when he first assumed the position, that the military had gone to war, but the department had not. And he wanted to change that. And I can assure you that this has not been lost on me or anyone in my group. So everything I say today should be viewed through that optic, as should the QDR. We are at wars, plural. My job, as I see it, is to focus on those areas where, from a policy perspective, we make the right decisions for the right reasons that have the greatest positive impact, not just on the warfighters in the field today, but those who will be deployed in the next 18 to 36 months, and the systems and individuals who will be deployed well after I leave this office. This is truly a high-wire act, where we are attempting to balance immediate requirements while ensuring a sensible, long-term policy that maintains premier, and I emphasize premier, military dominance over potential adversaries in the future. This isn't a U.S. government challenge. It's not a DOD challenge. It's a national challenge. And we cannot achieve our objectives without the dedication and support of our industrial partners. Despite spending almost $2 billion a day, which is a lot, the department doesn't actually build that many things. We pay others to provide the goods and services for our warfighters. We don't build fighters. We pay someone to design, test, perform quality assurance, assemble, test again, and then support thousands, hundreds of thousands of parts. We count on our partners to make it fly, make it sustainable, and make it perform the missions we expect it to perform. And I use this phrase partner because we in the department, again, cannot do it alone. And industry cannot do it alone. Both the department and industry, for better or worse, are codependent on one another. We're not going back, in most cases, to an arsenal system, as Dr. Hamray described, because we realized it didn't work. We cannot fulfill our responsibilities without our industry partners, and they cannot fulfill their fiduciary or, frankly, their patriotic responsibilities without the department. Even with this recognition, as the QDR states, the federal government as a whole, and the Pentagon in particular, needs to do a better job of understanding the true nature of our industrial base. I wish I could stand here today and say that the decades-long primary hands-off approach to our base could be remedied quickly. Unfortunately, I can't. The problems we face and the solutions we seek will take time to fully recognize and adequately address. As we have in the past, the department will continue to rely on our market forces to shape and sustain our base whenever possible. But that being said, the department must be prepared and must retain the ability to intervene when necessary to create and sustain innovation and essential industrial capabilities and skills that promote our national security. This means that a greater understanding of the industry is needed. The industry as a whole is a complex web of ad hoc teaming agreements, shifting stock symbols, and company mergers. Keeping track of this is a job in and of itself. On a side note, before anyone jumps to the conclusion that we're seeking to become some kind of Smithian hand lording over industry, let me assure you that I want on my tombstone, and I'm putting, as soon as I can figure out where the printing office is in the Pentagon, on our wall, what we need is more insight before we offer advice for more oversight. We simply do not have the insight we need today. We need first to know the facts, so that any prescriptions to problems identified are not gunslinging, but gunsmithing. And Dr. Hamray, I stole that line from you because I was quite taken by it some time ago. So one of the myths that I want to dispel today is the notion that the defense industry is this some monolithic sector of the economy whose key players are made up of a few individual companies. It's not true. The goods and services that the warfighter depends on reach far deeper into the overall economy. There are unique items that only the Department of Defense procures. But even there, we must recognize that they are dependent upon a complex and integrated supply chain of product suppliers. When the supply chain is constrained at the second, third, or even fourth level tiers, the ability of the primes to support our troops in battle is jeopardized. I realize that the effort we're undertaking is complex, but we believe it's necessary. Many of the defense industry's jobs that require the most perishable skills reside with the smaller, non-prime suppliers. Their survival is dependent on factors largely out of their control. They're small, highly specialized companies dependent on the primes and their unique requirements to fund the continued existence. The cascading effect to the subprimes is one of the primary reasons why we better need to understand, truly understand, the structure of this industry and the situations that sub-tiers face. This will help us understand potential impacts for programmatic decisions that we make. It will allow us to understand critical lower-tier providers, that we ensure that they have the capacity to respond to these immediate needs to get systems to the battlefield. that the continued supply of critical subcomponents to our base will not be jeopardized, and to ensure that the critical skilled jobs, and I want to emphasize that, skilled jobs are not lost to this nation. I'd like to cover one other area that I have long believed is far too overlooked to the health of the defense industrial base, and that's the financial community. And I thank Byron for his years of wisdom for making, getting me smart on this. You know, from small technology startups, which seek venture capital funding and pursue new products, to debt markets that provide the capital support as programs mature and evolve, the department must simply ensure that we don't take the access to capital for granted, and we must work to form a more transparent view of our requirements and long-term investment plans. In that vein, we recently conducted a roundtable for Dr. Carter with Wall Street analysts to give them more transparency, more vision, more understanding into what the department was planning. There are no shortage of other issues that our office has been engaged, from the Defense Production Act to conflicts of interest to rare earth minerals to biodefense to export controls, export promotions, solid rocket motors, next generation bombers, shipbuilding. So that's what our folks here, we did this morning, worked on those issues. The bottom line is I firmly believe we simply need in the industrial policy a more holistic approach. And it will be led by three goals: getting our office in front of issues instead of chasing them, striving to adopt rules of reason in all things related to industrial policy, and reestablishing a true partnership with industry and the financial community. Finally, I want to make clear that we should not confuse support for the private sector as advocacy. The department, the department's renewed engagement with industry doesn't mean that, as the QDR says, we will support sunset industries or prop up poor business models. As Secretary Gates has clearly demonstrated with his past two budget submittals, he is clearly prepared to terminate programs that are not needed in the current threat environment or are simply not performing. I'd like to conclude on a personal note, and although it may sound somewhat hokey to those who haven't had the opportunity to be in public service, in the short time I've been in the building, I've learned that industrial policy, my office in particular, and particularly my bosses, this is not an academic exercise. It's not a 9-to-5 job, as my wife and children have learned. If we want to maintain a competitive industry in an increasingly resource-constrained environment, then industry and government must work together to outline the requirements for future programs, to stick to those requirements, and to keep the skill jobs necessary to bring those programs to fruition. The bottom line is, I wouldn't come to work every day if I didn't firmly believe that industry and the department have, at this moment in time, with this leadership team, an opportunity to get in front of many of these key issues before they become problems. And I hope my office has a small role to play in that endeavor. We must open and keep open honest, transparent, clearly understandable lines of communication. And I believe that those threads and that vision is pulled through the QDR, and it's a good start for that climb. I appreciate CSIS hosting this event. I think it's very important, and I particularly appreciate everyone coming out. Hopefully the cars, the plow won't go by your cars before you leave today. Thank you very much.
We'll take a few questions, if you want to take a few questions from the podium before we move on to the panel. Just a couple to give people the opportunity to get questions in before we move on to the additional comments.
Okay.
Seeing only one, Terry Murphy in the back row there. Identify yourself, please, and your affiliation as you ask your question.
I'm Terry Murphy. I'm with MK Technology, and I have the honor to be also second-hatted with CSIS. It's really a comment, but to a fellow Midwesterner, and that is, it's not just the Cold War. I think we won WW2 with countless, I can't begin to tell you how many bombers were put out at Willow Run in about 10 minutes, and the Kaiser shipbuilding produced ships once a month, and everything else, just amazing performances when that was done. So I would only simply rewind the reel one war back. So nice job.
I appreciate those comments, and that's an important thing. It's also important to understand the transition that I think the QDR points out quite effectively. In all lines, all manufacturing lines eventually come to an end. That's just the nature of commerce. We at one point in time were manufacturing two aircraft per hour out in California. I had 150,000 employees. They were doing great work in World War II. And that was because the nation and industry responded to the call. And as we look at forward challenges, different challenges, it doesn't make sense to try to preserve, in my mind, that historic base if we're not also addressing possibly address the future requirements. The Defense Department, despite our budget, it's a zero-sum game. For everything that we spend on programs and platforms that we no longer require to address the threat, those are resources we are taking away from innovation and from technology. So I certainly understand. I think what we need to do in the department is to better communicate to both industry and, frankly, Capitol Hill, where it is we're headed and what type of investments we need to make in manufacturing and in technologies. But there's no shortage of stories of the ability for our government and for the nation to surge in times of need, and they're true and they're great stories. But my office is focused on thinking more forward about what's the next thing we need to surge on.
We got a couple more up front if you'll wait for the microphone. And we'll just do a couple more of these, and then we'll move on to the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Amy Butler with Aviation Week. I'm just curious. We had Secretary Gates announce a major fee, $614 million against Lockheed Martin, essentially. They're not earning that award fee for poor performance on JSF. Same day, David Altwig at the MDA had kind of a tirade about lack of quality in the products that MDA is receiving from its contractors. Do you think those issues are issues that are indicative of an industrial base that is atrophied? Are they bad business models on the part of the Pentagon or on the part of the contractors? Is it just poor contracting? Does that have anything to do with this industrial base issue?
I'd say no, no, and no. Next. No, I'm not qualified to talk to that point. That is, Dr. Carter has been following this issue closely. What I can say is that the department has been working closely with the contractor. It's obviously a very important program for us. We think it's going to be successful. We understand what the base required to support the program is. And I think we've taken, again, this is way out of my lane, and others here may, actually Byron might probably know more than I do about this, but I'm encouraged by the interaction between the department and the contractors. It's a good thing to see that it's been honest and open dialogue, and I think all parties are on board with where we need to go.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to focus on JSF, but just bigger picture, is there an overall quality problem that is making the industrial base situation worse? Companies aren't earning award fees for poor quality work or poor performance. That's hitting their bottom line, which is hitting their, R&D available dollars.
Sure. I wouldn't be qualified. I mean, I've only had small insights in that, and I haven't had enough time to make a judgment.
Let's do one last question, and then we'll have another question session after the panel has their remarks.
August Cole from the Wall Street Journal. Good morning. How concerned or what's the level of appreciation of a policy problem around a shareholder arsenal developing in the next decade, essentially having companies that are down to one product line on some of the programs like aircraft?
Well, I think it's a concern. My office in particular has been asked to address some issues in that regard. Everyone remembers, of course, the famous Last Supper that took place in 93. In fact, my boss, Dr. Carter, was at that meeting. So I think we're cognizant of that issue, and whether it be in, you know, shipbuilding or aircraft manufacturing, we understand that, and we're trying to get our arms around it. We have not come to any decision about what the policy should be. As I said, right now we're trying to get more insight than oversight. So I wouldn't expect to see any. I wouldn't expect to see any kind of prescriptions for any potential issues in the near term.
All right, thank you. If you'll hold the rest of your questions, we'll now turn to our panel of experts that have agreed to join us here this morning. Starting immediately to Mr. Lambert's left is Jeff Bialos. He is here because he had the same job that Brett has in the administration twice removed, the Clinton administration. To Jeff's left is Byron Callen, who here represents Wall Street here today. And it is noteworthy,
yes. and has not yet been arrested.
only in its. Yes. It is useful to note that there has not been a QDR before that even had the phrase "access to capital" in its text, and so there's a sea change just in the recognition of that dynamic as important to defense and to the industrial base. To Byron's left is Alan Chivotkin. Alan is here because, in fact, half of our industrial base now, half of the money that DOD spends under contract is with services rather than for platforms and systems and research and technology. And a recognition of that, I think, is something that is important for us to focus on today and to look at the QDR through that prism and lens. So Mr. Chivotkin is here representing that side of the equation. And then finally, Bill Greenwalt, who was also a previous Deputy Undersecretary for Industrial Policy in the Bush administration. So we've got a group here who can provide a variety of perspectives on this QDR itself and on what it says and on what it doesn't say. I'll ask that they'll each provide some remarks. You hold your questions. When the four of them have finished, we'll open the floor for questions, but I am reserving the first question for Brett Lambert, who has graciously agreed to stay through the panel session as well. So you get to think about what you're going to ask these guys as they're going through their process. That's right. So with that, Jeff, you've got the floor.
Helps to turn it on. Being here with John Hamery made me think about the changing eras, if you will, that we face. And we've been in a bull market in defense the last 7-8 years here after 9/11. And it does look like we're at something of a crossroads. And I think what John touched on is, are we back to the late 90s in a period when he gave a speech of bemoaning the fact that the capital value of major defense contractors was less than Martha Stewart and her enterprise. And the question is, as budgets flatten inevitably in the next period, is our industry able to weather the storm? And I would submit, I didn't come here to have this discussion per se, but I would submit our companies are better equipped today to weather a flattening of demand and maybe even some declination than they were a decade ago. But it points out the need for vigilance in an era when we're going to see potentially some flattening and declination of demand, and you're apt to see concerns about the industrial base. And I think John's point was we have to watch out for the fragilities in this era. But to put all this in context, we're here to talk about this in the context of the QDR. And let me make a few general comments and then talk about the defense industry. First of all, this QDR, it's evolutionary, not revolutionary, and that's to be expected. We have a Secretary of Defense in his third year in office, And this QDR is entirely consistent with, by the way, and quite good, I think, but entirely consistent with his speeches, actions, and budget decisions over particularly the last year and a half, but really his whole tenure of office. It would be shocking at this point if it was a radical departure. And I think that's good because I think continuity is good. But in that continuity is change because he's effectively said, let's shift the focus, let's shift the balance somewhat toward the wars we're fighting, and this particularly pertains to the acquisition community and the comment that Brett made that, you know, the Defense Department is at war and AT&L isn't. Let's shift the balance toward the wars we're fighting. And I think that's done that in every which way. And it's very hard to disagree, therefore, with the vectors in this QDR. A few other just general points of things I think that are noteworthy that are not covered in this QDR that relate in general ways to the industry. One is force structure. If you're going to shift the balance, one thing to think about is making adjustments to the force structure. We have an army under stress. We have an army that has shifted its focus toward the continuum of low-intensity conflicts they're fighting. But there are really two questions going forward, which is, one, is the army really institutionalizing this change away from the concept of fighting the big one to essentially becoming, in some respects, a large special operations force? And two, can we shift the force structure, the active army force and the reserve, in a way that takes the stresses off? And I think these issues were not addressed in the QDR, but my impression is they're going to be addressed going forward. I would just say it's hard to restructure the force when it's at war, frankly. But I think it is an important issue if you go forward. Second, which again relates to the industry, little discussion of interoperability among coalition forces, particularly Europeans. Lots of discussion in the QDR about partnership, which is important, but I think there's not that much focus on less focus on Europe and the role of Europe in our defense. In part, that's probably in deference to the fact that the NATO strategic concept has not come out yet. But I would say there are two points here. One, if you look at who it is we fight with in expeditionary warfare, who goes to war with us, it's our European brethren. And my own view is we need to do much more things now, a more robust agenda to maintain interoperability with that force, and that would help promote transatlantic integration if we did that in the defense sector. Two, I think that... And so we need greater interoperability among forces likely to continue to be at different levels of capability for years to come. Two, the reality is Europe has largely become debellicized, and other than two countries, the France and the UK, most of Europe is focused on Petersburg tasks and low-intensity warfare. And we need to encourage that because we need to have that burden shared. And all of this points towards some degree of more cooperative defense programs with Europeans and more efforts to ensure that we can work with them in a net-centric environment. And I think those, to me, should be priorities, and I would hope that as we go forward, while not mentioning the QDR, they become greater priorities. I was heartened to see a mention of the EU in the QDR, and I didn't go back and look, but my guess is this is the first QDR that mentions the European Union. And it reflects the fact that the EU is taking on a more prominent role in defense, particularly in this low-intensity side of the equation, and has just put a package of directives out there to regulate the defense market and to open its internal defense market. And one point I think that's not quite mentioned in the QDR, but I think is an important point, is I believe the Defense Department needs to engage much more deeply with the European Union on a range of issues, from regulating the defense market to civil-military cooperation. We just finished a study at Johns Hopkins called Fortresses and Icebergs, and that was one of the key findings in that study. I think there has been forward movement in the Pentagon on this, where to the point where, you know, you hear people on the policy side of the House saying, we're open to engaging with the EU, but I think we have to move beyond that and develop a robust agenda with our most important partner in these areas. Now, let me turn now to the defense industry. As I said, as I kind of jokingly said, there is not much in the QDR specifically on the defense industry, but what there I think is quite good, and I think Brett has laid out a very good vision in this area. And I think the QDR is properly focused on both the demand and the supply side of the equation, if you will, and the question is, What are the acquisition system deficiencies on the demand side? And what do we do, and this is really the question, to ensure we have the defense industrial capabilities that are robust and competitive source defense industrial capabilities to meet our national security needs for the future? And particularly, as I said at the outset, how do we do this in an era of potentially declining demand? We're back to that era, potentially, where it's flattening and potentially declining. And how do we make sure that we address the fragilities of the industry, in effect, as they happen? On the demand side, the QDR, I think, asked the right question, which is how do we institutionalize the rapid wartime acquisition capability? You know, there's been really, for many years, two acquisition systems at the Pentagon. There's the long-term one we all know with large programs that start with requirements, and that's the bulk, been the bulk of the spending. The second is one that wasn't all that big until after 9/11, and we started fighting these wars, and now has become much larger, and that's a short-term acquisition system driven by the needs in the field of a combatant commander. And it's sprung up in the Pentagon a series of ad hoc committees, ad hoc approaches, and lots of money. You bring it to Aberdeen and test it, and if it's good, we'll use it, is one extreme. And things like MRAP grew out of that. They didn't grow out of that long-term system. And the question is really, the QDR asked the right question. It doesn't really give a solution to this. Is should we do something to institutionalize this kind of a wartime system? Do we reform the big system, or do we do something to give us the standing, if you will, authorities and monies to better organize our effort for this sort of more short-term exigency-based system? And I think that's a fundamental challenge going forward, not addressed, and you know, I think that's a challenge for this group, Brett and his colleagues in the Pentagon. On the supply side, again, I think the QDR does suggest, it hints at a more robust, not robust, a more interventionist tilt, if you will, in terms of industrial policy. We've always had industrial policy at the Pentagon, but it tends to be ad hoc and program specific. And I think what Brett has sort of suggested and the QDR hints at is creating a more coherent, holistic approach to industrial policy across the board. A few comments on the framework for this. Fundamentally, demand drives supply. That is to say, you know, you're not going to buy things largely because of industrial needs. You're going to buy things because we have national security needs for those things. But that said, supply has to inform demand, and the capabilities the industry can offer get taken into account in shaping defense demand. I think within that framework, there are a number of steps and tools that have to be taken, and some of the tools have fallen into abeyance. I don't think there's any magic to these tools. Monitor and assess the supplier base, particularly relative to the priorities set forth in the QDR. Take industrial capabilities into account in shaping acquisition strategies. When we work on the demand side in the Pentagon, taking the defense industrial capabilities into account, considering foreign sources of supply, establishing some sensible organizational conflict of interest rules, adding commercial suppliers, making it more sensible for commercial suppliers to play, merger reviews, maybe we need some guidance here as we go into this new era, and some ensuring better stewardship by, a good stewardship by primes of the defense supplier base. I'm not going to talk about all those, but I want to touch on a few. Look, on monitoring the supplier base, that's what Brett's office and Brett are about, and that's the historic responsibility. What you need to do here is matrix demand to supply. The QDR lays out a bunch of priority areas, and what I would urge them to do is to go sector by sector and look at each of these sectors. The issue here is resources. Poor Brett's office has atrophied over the years, I don't think necessarily by intent, and he just today doesn't have the resources to do this. So I would ask the Pentagon leadership to give Brett more resources to bring to the task so the ambition in the QDR can be realized, because without more resources, he can't do much more than react. And so that's point one. The second point, so and they need
I
to do...
you should stop there. I think that was a good point.
Shaping acquisition strategies. We began to do this in the late 90s, and it really fell into abeyance. When we look at the demand side in the Pentagon, we need to look at industrial capabilities and bring that into play. Now, again, that doesn't mean we decide we make source selection decisions on the basis of, you know, we need this industrial capability, therefore we're going to do it that way. It does mean as we shape long-term acquisition strategies in a capability area like radar or whatnot, we need to look at industrial capabilities as part of that equation. And I would favor a more holistic look in capability sectors at, let's say, sectors like radar, like UAVs, and where you look at, you bring together the requirements, the budget, the acquisition, and the user community, and you essentially do a set of trade-offs in a holistic and coherent way. And that's not really done today. And I think that's the way to bring industrial capabilities into account. And if you begin to shape acquisition strategies that way, you can do things like address supplier base issues. You can say, let's have some competition at the subsystem level in program A and B and C. We can eliminate some program redundancy if we do that too. Foreign sources of supply. The QDR mentions foreign sources of supply. I think we need to look at our defense industrial base in an expanded way, and indeed we have in a practice in the last 8 years. As the study we did showed, foreigners have gotten a good portion of the uptick and the bull market, and most of the major foreign firms today have secure facilities here, a ticket to the dance, and I think we need to take more steps to encourage more globalization with our industrial partners in support of that. And my second to last point is on export controls, which is segues, this issue of globalization segues into. I was heartened to see in the QDR and in the President's State of the Union the focus on export controls, which is the key impediment to this kind of globalization and collaboration with allies. I just came back from a trip to the UK where senior acquisition officials there are now talking about ITAR-free programs. When His Majesty's government, our closest allies, starts talking about ITAR-free programs, we need to listen. ITAR is not the root of all evil, to be sure, and we need export controls, but we need to listen. OCI is an important issue going forward, and I know the rules are coming out. It is not directly mentioned in the QDR, but I think having organizational conflict of interest rules in implementation of the Weapons Acquisition Reform Act is a critical issue for the industry going forward. And I think there's some things that need to be done here, and I do worry here that we need a set of rules that provide greater certainty to industry. We need to carve out the most sensitive tasks from these omnibus contracts on the demand side and lay out a policy that says, it's good to have omnibus contracts on the support side. Those omnibus contracts should carve out the source selection, test, and eval activities that are creating these conflict situations. I think we need some merger guidance here on what happens when you have a company with a lot of support services buying a company with products in the same field. And I believe that we really need to look for some guidance here to say that we're going to have structural solutions in those kinds of mergers. Firewalls don't work. Finally, I think we need a set of regs that create some safe harbors. I don't think it makes any more sense to give all the discretion in this area to program managers to carve solutions out to OCI when the solutions affect the structure of the industry. I think we have to create some broad safe harbors and clear rules. For example, if the answer is that a separate subsidiary will cure and mitigate some OCIs, I think we need to lay that out explicitly and not leave the parameters of that to, you know, a program officer. If collaborative activities between Company A and B are going to give rise to OCIs in an industry where teaming is the norm, I think we ought to not leave that to a program officer to do. Finally, on the merger review, as we get into this era again here of flattened demand, you're apt to see more consolidation. And I do think, again, we're going to look to some guidance here on a couple of points. One is I would like to see some guidance on distinguishing innovation markets from legacy markets. I think we probably should be more willing to accept consolidation in the legacy area than in markets like a UAV market where innovation is so critical. Two, I think we have to think about the role of private equity. What is the feeling in the Pentagon in the role of private equity as a steward of a sector where we really would prefer stewardship with a long-term vision in mind? And so let me close on that, but I think the question is, Brett needs the resources, and can the Pentagon give him the resources to take the set of tools I just outlined and use that to implement the vision he articulated? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Now we'll turn to an exploration of what is perhaps one of the most complex dialogue arenas in Western civilization, and that is the dialogue between Wall Street and Washington. And for insight on that and the industrial base views of QDR, I'll turn to Byron Callen. Byron?
Good. Thank you. Thank you, David. Thanks, everybody, for coming here this morning. I want to try and keep my thoughts fairly brief and, you know, start out with the financial markets perspective. I guess the first thought is, just as the QDR talked about a nuanced defense industrial base, the financial markets are obviously very nuanced as well. We tend to think of Wall Street as, you know, maybe akin to the very large defense contractors, but the financial community is also very nuanced. It's not just the large sell-side research analysts that are quoted in the newspapers. It's a whole range of institutional investors, both here in the United States and, frankly, globally. Jeff just mentioned the private equity community. They have been a very important player, and I think will continue to be a very important player in shaping the industry. Venture capital is important at sowing the seeds for the young emerging companies, and clearly commercial banks that provide credit lines and assist in the merger and acquisition activity are part of this broader financial community too. So I'd expand that notion. It's not just Wall Street, it's the financial markets in general. I do think, you know, it was very significant that the QDR chose to acknowledge not just the defense industrial base in approximately two pages, but that paragraph about the acknowledging the role of the financial community in basically maintaining and shaping the industrial base was unique. It's not just in the United States. It's something I haven't seen in the white papers that have come out of Australia or the French white paper last year, the UK papers, a green paper yesterday, and I think there was one, an acquisition paper that just came out. So the capital markets have been a key strength in shaping this industrial base, and I think that role and that acknowledgement is very significant going forward. You know, my perspective right now, that the large public companies are in fairly good shape financially, but the small to mid-sized companies are going to continue to tap capital for their growth needs and for consolidation, I think, is going to continue. There will be restructuring of the industry going forward. And really, you know, kind of across the spectrum for the publicly traded companies at least, equity is going to be an important component to retain and attract people and provide stable career paths. I know Boeing, for example, recently did an equity contribution to their pension plan that provided security for their people going forward. So this isn't just about the mergers and acquisitions or divestitures. It's also about a component of compensation that the defense industry has to compete against the private companies or public companies outside of defense as well, that I think is important. There was a lot in the industrial part of the QDR about dialogue and transparency, and I think, you know, this administration has really gotten off on a good start. Brett mentioned the meeting recently with Wall Street analysts, but I think that's extended to CEOs and industry as well, too. I think those are important means. They're not obviously ends in their self. You know, from my perspective, the most important issue for the financial markets is going to continue to be risk and return. I think the nature of this beast is that risk is just going to be inherent in the defense industry as it is in other sectors. Investors inevitably are going to want stability and predictability, but the future is apt to be unstable and unpredictable. Nothing really unique or insightful in that comment, but there's always going to be that tension. This dialogue and openness and transparency, I think, can help that. But even other parts of the QDR suggested that there's going to be continued uncertainty and opportunity in things like the aircraft modernization programs, you know, what happens to spare parts demand as you flush out older generation aircraft. Those are parts that the financial community is just going to have to work through. There was language about fixed price contracts and the alignment of profitability with performance. So those issues are going to continue to weigh on how investors look at the sector. I think in the past, where capital has really been spooked by what's happened in the defense sector has really come from these big surprises, sudden surprises, abrupt changes. The PBD 753 decision in 2004, where we saw a number of programs canceled abruptly, the F-22, C-130, that came as a surprise and I think really caused people to pull back from this sector. The other obvious era or periods of era where investors have shied away from the sector have been where risk has overwhelmed a particular company. Lockheed in the early 1970s with the C-5 program, or McDonnell Douglas with the C-17 program in 1990. So I think this dialogue and transparency that was addressed in the industrial base, I think it's very important that a good part of that is going to acknowledge the risk and returns that are expected on both sides of the fence. Finally, the QDR can't encompass all the issues. We could have a 1,000-page document, I think, pretty quickly, and maybe 200 or 300 pages on the industrial base. Yeah. But there were some things that were kind of left hanging, and maybe these will come up in the Q&A discussion about the QDR and the industrial base. I think Brett mentioned the comment about sunset industries and poor business models. I don't really know at this point what is a sunset industry. I've got my own ideas, but we could argue 10 or 15 years ago that maybe track and wheeled vehicles might be something of a sunset industry, and yet a program like MPREP has proven how important those shifts and changes could be. There was a comment in the back of the room about Willow Run, and it's just a reminder that it's not just the defense industry, it's the broader economy and the skills and capabilities that the broader economy brings to the defense, to the national security of the United States. So thinking of this about how do we sustain a qualitative advantage in defense when other companies have access to technology and lower-cost manufacturing skills, I think is going to be very critical going forward and something that we could write a book on easily. Those are my remarks.
Thank you, Byron. Thank you very much. We'll turn now to the services side of the equation. As I mentioned earlier, Defense now spends about as much money under contract with services as it does in procurement and research and development. That's aside. Actually, to call it an industrial base sort of implies a level of imprecision in the term. But as some of you know, we here at the Center for Strategic and International Studies have for a number of years spent a good bit of analytical time on what we call the professional services industrial base, that is, those industries and companies and workers who do provide those services to national security. And so now we'll turn to Alan Chavotkin for his reflections and views. Alan?
David, thank you, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to be here. The Professional Services Council is a national trade association. We represent over 340 companies, all of whom sell professional and technical services to the federal government. So we naturally focus on the way the Defense Department buys goods and services generally and services in particular. And I was struck by the QDR because it starts with a description of some changing department missions. And, of course, in our perspective, the industrial base exists to support the department's missions. And the recognition of this evolving change in missions is important because the industrial base has to exist to support that. The QDR talked, interestingly, about a whole-of-government approach, reiterating some of the Secretary's views on the and support of the President's views of a 3D strategy of defense, diplomacy, and development. But then went on to raise some concerns about the quality of the interagency coordination. And so I think we've got some goals set out, yet some challenges ahead. It talks about the importance in the industrial base of a total defense force, which recognizes the contributions that the active military and Guard and Reserve can make along with the defense civilian employees and the contractor community. and the contributions that each of those make. Yet it proposes to reduce the amount of support contractors working for the Defense Department. So I think there's some questions about priorities and signals. It recognizes that the industrial base is not monolithic. In fact, I'd submit that it's not even very well organized. And so as we look at differentiating among the many suppliers, I think it's important that we, at some point, and this QDR isn't a place to do that, otherwise it would be 10,000 pages, not simply 1,000 or 160, but to look at the contributions and the role of domestic versus foreign. Almost no mention of small business, but the role of the small, mid-tier, and large firms that we're looking at. The differentiation between platform companies and integrators and services providers. Brett touched on the importance between prime contractors and subcontractors, particularly those who are critical technology providers. Byron already talked about the role of financial institutions. Secondly, there was a discussion of the workforce, although not a very elaborate discussion of the workforce. Repetition, it seemed, of some of the clear departmental policies already in place to grow the size of the federal workforce and the Defense Department workforce in particular. And that's a goal that we support. I mean, it's unquestionable that the Defense Department's workforce has atrophied not only in the critical areas of acquisition policy, but in some of those technical skills as well. And it's important to approach to regrow some of that. But it has to be done strategically. And I think the guidance that the Deputy Secretary of Defense has issued, some of the statements that Undersecretary Carter has made and the Office of Management and Budget have discussed, focuses on that strategic nature, identifying the key skills and how to accomplish growing the workforce in a strategic manner. Unfortunately, what we've seen so far is growth that is opportunistic rather than strategic. And some of the insourcing, and I could take the rest of the time to talk just about insourcing, but I won't. We see much of the insourcing activities taking place in the Defense Department today being driven by the budget rather than by any overall strategy. And I think to the extent that the workforce issues can be addressed as part of a four-year strategy, the department has to come to recognition of how it wants to address the insourcing issues. Baked into that budget are some arbitrary savings from this insourcing activity, and I think that needs a little bit more inspection as well. So if we've got a new strategy for the department's missions and we look at an industrial base capability, we have to look at how the government buys goods and services and what the acquisition system is that links these two to support the department's mission. And I think, as Brett mentioned in his remarks and the QDR properly notes, one size can't fit all in the industrial base, and nor can one size fit all in an acquisition system. The QDR talks about the importance of agility in the acquisition, but there's little indication to me that there's going to be change at the core system. What I do see is several references to developing ways to circumvent the current system, whether that's the creation of a contingency acquisition fund or rapid acquisition cells. These are really recognitions of the challenge at the core system and the importance of the agility and ways to make sure that the department can meet its mission. And if we have that at the edges, we ought to consider doing so at the core as well. We need to look then at the techniques that are available. And Byron mentioned some of the techniques available. I thought the QDR did a masterful job of acknowledging some of the acquisition techniques around fixed price development, for example, but noted that that's to be used only where appropriate. And I think that's a signal to folks that this is not the only policy to be available. And in fact, a recent report from the Defense Business Board highlights the findings that fixed price contracting, particularly in terms of development, is rarely appropriate. And I hope the department and its acquisition techniques would take a look at that. And in a slightly unrelated context, Norm Augustine once said that the area is unblemished by success, and I think he could talk specifically to fixed-price development as that poster child. And finally, if we understand that we have a workforce available and an acquisition system that can support how the department buys its goods and services, and we're using the right techniques to do that, then we have to look at a set of potentially conflicting policies and priorities that have been addressed. And Jeff mentioned some of them, and Brett mentioned some of them. I think the department, the QDR, doesn't really talk about how to balance some very significant, challenging priorities and policies, from competition to the role of organizational conflicts. How do we handle job retention and creation, particularly at the technology level, with issues about Buy America, particularly in contingency contracting? So there's a whole list of policy issues that I think are touched on because of the strategies in the QDR, but certainly not resolved. I think that gives Brett and his colleagues in the department plenty of opportunity for more work. I'm hopeful that the partnership will exist, will bring us lots of opportunity for dialogue. But these are just a few of my favorite things.
Thank you, Alan, very much. Now our final panel member, Bill Greenwalt, also served as the Deputy Undersecretary for Industrial Policy during the second Bush administration, and here to reflect on his views of the QDR. Bill.
Thank you, Dave. It's actually kind of nice to go last, because I can pretty much say everything they've said, and they pretty much touched on most of the issues. But this is, I think, the QDR is extremely important for the first time institutionalizing industrial base considerations into the QDR, and I think that's something that a lot of outside observers and industry has been hoping to see, and I think it's a very positive first step. I think we've heard the number of things that are in there, and the QDR industrial base section is really asking the right questions. So I think I might take this just to the next step and say, well, how should that be implemented, and what are the challenges to implementing it? And I think the first issue to do is to gain visibility of the supply chain, and to do that, I think I have to key off on Jeff Bialas's point, is you need the capability in the workforce to do that. And since the reduction in the acquisition workforce over the last 20 years, industrial base analysis has not been is not as strong as it used to be. And to build that up, it's hopeful that of those 20,000 acquisition workforce positions that the Secretary would like to get, hopefully a few of those happen to be industrial-based analysts and who can really cut across and look at the industry. Brett has some tremendous staff and some tremendous capabilities there, but they need to clone them. And they're so good that even David's hired one of them. So I mean, it's.
Is that insourcing or
outsourcing? That's a good question. We have to look into that. So I think the workforce is going to be key, and therefore, but it's not just going to be the workforce that's hired. It's the getting into the PEO office and getting into the capability managers to have them start looking at what is it we need to cut across these programs, and getting into DDR&E and the S&T community to look at and institutionalize, these are the type of industrial base and partners we're going to need in the next decade and beyond. Once you have a visibility into the supply chain and into what supply chain you want, you really need a criteria for intervention if you're actually going to intervene. And that is going to be one that it's going to require a lot of thought and a lot of analysis. But you can break it up into various time frames, like what is it you're going to need to do rapid acquisition? In other words, what do you need to support the NRAPs and the counter IDs and the ISR needs of the future, and how is that industrial base looking? looking into the midterm, kind of your typical MDAPs and smaller programs, and then out into the future as far as future technology. Now, I know your office started developing that type of criteria in a number of studies dealing with the S&T base going out in the future, and that criteria may be a good one to start applying to the various segments. What are those technologies and what are those areas where we need to be ahead of the world? What are those areas where we can partner with our European and other allied industrial bases? And what are theirs that we're happy to be dependent upon the commercial industrial base? And that's getting that criteria for intervention, I think, is going to be a key. I think the third area to be successful here is going to be funding. And there are a number of programs designed to how to intervene in the industrial base and to support the industrial base, whether it's DPA, Title III money, or whether it's Mantech money. But the problems that one faces in these are more near-term than that. In other words, you're faced with how do I intervene? I've got a supplier that's going out of business. What do we need to do here? And where do you get the money? Well, if it's within a program, probably the program's going to deal. But if this cuts across a multitude of programs, it's very difficult to get the resources to actually help to intervene there. And I think the Congress tried to set up what was called the Industrial Innovation Base and Innovation Fund to do that. And the issue is whether that is the appropriate mechanism or not. But something like that is probably needed. And then if you, the department is going to continue to partner with the commercial industrial base. An industrial base policy needs to really look at the acquisition process and the acquisition system and the incentives and disincentives to non-traditional commercial contractors continuing to be in the industrial base. And this is a long, long history. Acquisition reform of the mid-90s essentially tried to bring these companies in, I think was very successful. Some of that is that consensus may be under threat at the current time, so this is a good time to ensure that those companies and those processes and those barriers are maintained. And then obviously there are a number of areas where there's still barriers to bringing in non-traditional contractors, which could help the base. And obviously looking at whatever disincentives to future innovation that can. So with that, since Jeff pretty much did all the rest of my topics, I will key it over for questions.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Let me give you an administrative announcement before we proceed into the questions. At 10 o'clock, and it's right now about 9 minutes after 10, at 10 o'clock another event began in here in the basement. It's on the other side of that back wall. The Philippine foreign minister is giving a talk.
You want us to go over?
No, we're not going to go over, but I want to alert you to that. I don't actually... we won't take a poll on which one you'd rather attend, but I do want to alert you to that because there may be some. They've been asked to be respectful of our needs for noise abatement, and we've been asked to do the same. And particularly when we wrap up and get ready to leave, I'll ask you to exit with the quietness of new fallen snow. I am also here to tell you that it is not yet snowing, and so we're all still fine in that regard. Let me now open up the floor to questions. We do have staff with microphones. I would ask you to raise your hand. I'll recognize you. You wait for the microphone, identify yourself and your affiliation, and then you can direct your question to one, two, or all of the panel here. Let me start over here on the left, since I ignored the that side of the room. My left, your right, during the first round of questions. Here comes the mic.
Bill Courtney with CSC. The Last Supper was referred to. How did the consolidation after the Last Supper work out on balance? Were there any lessons learned that would be helpful for what may lie ahead if there is flattening and perhaps decline in defense spending?
Well, I mean, I don't think we truly know the answer to that. I think one of the – what I take away, and this is just a personal view having been in the industry when it occurred, was that it was necessary. It was the right thing to do at the right time. And I think what we struggle with is from a business point of view, it was largely a consolidation of stock symbols, not necessarily capacity. And we perhaps overlooked as a department the need to promote the consolidation at the capacity level. So we weren't working at 20 or 30% of a factory's capacity, and the taxpayer was paying that overhead rate. So I think, I think it was the right thing to do at the right time, and I have tremendous respect for everyone who was involved in that process, that they lived through it. I think if there were to be not another Last Supper, because I don't think that's going to happen, but maybe a first breakfast at some point, that we would try to think more about the business implications, the financial implications, and what incentives and disincentives we would look to. I'd actually be interested in everyone's comment on that, particularly buyers, because they see this in the financial community all the time, the implications of that consolidation. So,
well, I think you certainly created, maybe Jeff mentioned it, and I alluded to it. I think for a number of the companies, the large companies that were at the forefront of the consolidation, you've got a much more financially stable industry right now. The large companies, some have more cash in their balance sheets than they do debt right now. So, you know, with whatever comes out of the budget in the next couple of years, I just don't think companies should be able to work through this without the kind of perils of Pauline drama we've seen in the past, Lockheed I alluded to in the early 70s or McDonnell Douglas in the 90s. So I think from a financial perspective, that's probably been the most significant change.
If I could just add, one of the other implications is the way the department – approach the marketplace. So the growth of large IDIQ contracts, large multiple award contracts, the growing the size of the procurements, in part as a result of the shrinking of the acquisition workforce, those two factors, I think, both have to be addressed, one on the industrial side and one on how the department goes to market. And thus, over time, we've lost some of the agility and flexibility that the department has, and I think both from a capability standpoint as well as a contracting standpoint, we're now seeing the results of that consolidation as new markets and new requirements are emerging and sort of compromising a little bit on the flexibilities.
Yeah. I mean, as I alluded to at the outset, I think there are some lessons learned from it. One is, I think as we go into – if and as we go into a declination period and a consolidation period, we need to be more vigilant about the effect on the industrial base. The fragilities that emerged in the last cycle, the debt on Raytheon and Lockheed, were sort of known but really only became a focus late in the game. And I think there needs to be – this goes back to the monitoring point – more monitoring of this. I will say – it was an inevitability, and the question you have to ask yourself, do we have a sufficient number of robust competitors in the core sectors in the industry? And I think we kind of came out of it. And the answer, you know, special exceptions, the answer is by and large, yes. We had as much competition as we can afford in the major sectors.
All right. Other questions? I'm having trouble seeing hands because actually the lights are more bright than your faces. So I think there's one in the back, and then we'll come over here. So, yes.
Hello, my name is Raj Sharma from the FAIR Institute. And my question is pertaining to some of the issues addressed around bringing in really third and fourth tier suppliers or attracting new suppliers that are capable of addressing some of the emerging needs, suppliers that are really bringing new and emerging technologies. And could you speak to a little bit about, we've written a paper around some of the barriers to entry in the in the federal market, from a defense market specifically, defense sector specifically, what do you see as really key barriers to entry and key barriers to attracting those types of companies that are developing new and emerging technologies?
I guess I'd start by saying, having spent my previous career working with many of those companies, you might want to switch your question to what isn't a barrier to entry into the federal marketplace. And this is why I think the QDR was hopefully effective in at least illustrating our commitment to begin to understand the complexities of that issue, because it everyone up here has a different take on it. There's a financial take. Can they get access to capital? Byron alluded to the fact that many of our primes have two-year backlogs, at least. Our second and third tier may have 6 months, some 12 months. The restriction to access for capital for them and the procurement process we have and how we pay them and how they can get paid from the primes has a tremendous effect on their capacity for both innovation and growth. And we have not, I think, adequately addressed the complexity of that issue. There will always be barriers. We can't rewrite all the DFARs that would need to be written. It's just not going to happen. And that's why I go back to that we have to rule with reason. We have to do what's practical and what's in the best interest of the taxpayer and the warfighter. One of the vehicles that I think has been quite effective is this rapid acquisition process. And to the points that were made earlier, there's always a danger of that process. And, in fact, I've seen it with one program where I was looking at something got into a rapid acquisition process with an IOC, I think, of 2018. And so, you know, as the system adjusts, you know, the systems, the building will adjust. So that's always a danger. But I think it's a serious question on a whole bunch of different levels is how we promote this innovation. And I think what's exacerbated, and at least in my concern, what's exacerbated the issue is the collapse of access to capital. And I see this quite often in the smaller firms. And it's not just the firms that are trying to offer innovative solutions for rapid deployment. It's the second and third tiers providing to programs of record that can't get access to capital, that's forcing the primes to actually make investments that are, in fact, unnatural acts. So I don't have an answer to that question. I think we don't understand the intricacies of that question well enough yet.
Let me add two seconds. Just historically, the concerns have always been around by commercial firms, intellectual property rights, the issue of what to do with the technology, whether it can be what the export control process is going to deal with, and general unique acquisition rules and regulations and auditing and financial burdens that they have to place. And historically, there have been a number of ways to allow those companies to participate, whether it's commercial item exemptions or other transaction contracting authorities. And the issue, I think, in today's environment is we can easily buy commercial off the shelf, but can we actually get modifications to those, and what are those rules having impact? So I think we're kind of in that transition, but it's a number of issues that historically the Congress and the administration has been trying to address to bring access to these non-traditionals. So we'll go from there.
And it's probably worth noting that that's an issue that you never actually get to the end of and say, okay, we got that one fixed, now what? Because it will constantly evolve in that way. I think I saw a hand up or a couple of hands up over here. Let me take the guy at the middle table there. We haven't had a middle table question yet on this side.
Joe Lissenden from ATK. In the context of the insight before oversight comment, as well as some information that I've heard from Secretary Lynn this past fall, who was kind of framing the issue, which is operating the railroad at the same time you're laying the track. And a lot of good ideas came out here today from the intertemporal nature of looking at the industrial base in addition to the intertemporal time way to look at the industrial base. How do you intend, Mr. Lambert, to prioritize these great ideas that are here and getting that insight at the same time that, you know, some congressional decisions are pending and industries are changing and forming, reforming and restructuring very quickly at the same time, which will ultimately impact defense capabilities.
Well, of course, I constantly and fervently agree with Secretary Lynn.
let's make sure so, we get that
oh,
in.
Sorry. He has, I mean, I've known Secretary Lynn for some time. He has a unique perspective, having been in both industry and the government. And I think his insights, as well as those of Dr. Carter, and frankly, Secretary Gates, bring again, a kind of a new paradigm for understanding these industrial complexities. In terms of priority, I have to say it is. Everyone said this when I came in, that you're gonna be drinking with a fire hose. I had no idea what the challenges that the department faces across the services and across policy. You know, we immediately set out to understand items better. We've met with your CEO. We've met with most of the company's CEOs in here, and that's new. And what we can't figure out, and I've had this discussion with Dr. Carter, we don't know why the department stopped having these meetings and stopped gaining the insight and creating the transparency and dialogue. So we're learning in real time, and I think that goes to Secretary Lynn's comments about trying to run a railroad while you're laying the tracks. In terms of priorities, I can only say that I've now learned from Microsoft Office how you move tasks to 8 a.m. But it is difficult when you get calls because our office, as all these folks up here know, and have had to deal with. You know, we have a reactionary portion, which is CFIUS and FOCI, and where we're on clocks that are not of our own making. And so a lot of the priorities are not of our choosing. They're dictated to us by law. And so our priorities literally shift daily in terms of the tactical priorities. What I'm trying to do, and I think what everyone has reinforced here, is that the Office of Industrial Policy should be thinking ahead. We should be thinking about not solving yesterday's mistakes, but trying to address tomorrow's problems. And I'm desperately trying to get our office oriented in that direction. We're not there yet, I have to be honest, and it's going to take us some time to get there.
Let's see. Let's go to here and then up to the front here. Thank you, Jesse. Thank you.
Bill Edgar with IHS Jaynes. On the question around broadly around the partnership, this is probably more for the panel, no offense, Mr. Lambert, but given that you're speaking
Bill
directly.
He used to work with me, so obviously.
Yes, and then and that I never want to set you up in that respect because it ever comes back in that respect. But around the partnership, I'd be interested in your thoughts around the impact, particularly as you look at developments in the UK on East Pacific Rim Asia in terms of acquisition procurement policies, particularly on the public-private partnership model, and the impact which ultimately comes down in the partnership with industry and the government's burden sharing, which is driven heavily by the investment environment in these areas. Is that a role looking forward, particularly with the austerity in the economy, with the austerity around the budgeting right now, and looking at how do you balance then the investment for the two wars and still keep the long-term investment going around strategy? And if so, or if not, rather, you know, how does that then affect the transatlantic relationships when the criteria for the businesses in Europe that we want to integrate are changing against the fiscal, of course, and the budgetary constraints that they're under?
I'll try the first question, then maybe, Jeff, you can go for the second. I don't know. PFIs and such and the partnerships that are going on around there rely on a long-term contracting arrangement. And now there are energy savings performance contracts in the U.S., which are 10 years long. They can go a little longer, and there are a few others like that. But in the last few years, what we're seeing is the length of contracts actually going down. And so that's so you're going to have a hard time getting industry to make the type of investments that they're making in the UK long term, because they need to know what the return is going to be in 5-10 years. And if you only have a 3-year contract, you're going to have a hard time having those type of partnerships. So in one sense, the acquisition system is kind of moving away from that here, while our allies are looking for cost-saving ways to partner with industry and having a lot more longer-term contracts. So, but I don't know about as far as the latter part, as far as how that's going to mishmash is going to occur. I think industry will kind of just, you know, adapt differently, and while our partners overseas may have a different perspective and ability to do that, the question is whether the Department of Defense will want to do that or not. And if they do, then obviously there might be some opportunities for them because they have experience with that.
Well, I don't have a lot to add. I agree with a lot of what Bill just said. I mean, I do think an unfortunate set of circumstances arose here over a period of time when the other transaction authority here sort of withered on the vine, so to speak, under political pressure. And I think that's unfortunate. I think in the period that we're entering again here, you would like to see more creative use of that kind of authority. You would like to see models like leasing in some contexts, like PFI-type models. I heard a laugh over here, but I mean, it's the environment for it has just not been great, but it may be that as the numbers flatten, you know, these types of things work. I could give you one example. There is a program called NextView, I believe it's called. That's a good example of the kind of future we ought to think about in some of these areas. I mean, this is a program that's designed by the defense agency that buys imagery data. And in the past, the idea would be, let's build a satellite system. We'll build a satellite system for this kind of imagery data. They did this a different way. Rather, they said, we're going to let a long-term contract to buy imagery data. Here's the data we want. And we'll sign a long-term contract with the winner. And then the winner signed the contract and took the contract to the bank and got project finance and went and built a satellite system. You know, that's the kind of model you would like to see, particularly in areas where, there's some commercial market going on, and the companies can sort of value the service and figure out how to do this. And you get the government out of being a program manager, out of building satellite systems, basically. And I do think it would be great to be able to see more creativity in this field. As I said, unfortunately, the political overlay has made this very hard.
We're reaching the end of our time. I anticipated actually the time for another question, but I didn't anticipate the time for the answers. And I think actually that's not a slap, because I actually think that was a very serious question and deserved a thorough answer, as did all of them. Clearly, we have only begun to scratch the surface of the issues here this morning, and we could go on for another hour and a half and move forward. I want to do a couple of closing remarks. We do try to end these things on time because we recognize people have other commitments as well. But we're happy to stick around and take some questions after the mics are turned off and help you out in that regard. These are clearly critical questions that have been raised by everybody up here this morning. CSIS is going to continue to analyze and report on these and to hold events like these to sort of further the public debate, because this has been a neglected area for many, many years here. What did we hear this morning? We heard Brett Lambert describe DOD's commitment to doing a better job, but we heard all of the panel describe ways in which they're going to need a lot of help in order to be able to execute on that commitment. And I think that as we move forward collectively across the government, it's going to take all of our efforts. Where do we go from here? The QDR actually cites a number of additional areas in need of study, and from space and anti-access to forces and manpower, and it's not clear what the impact of those studies will be. Clearly, some programs and contracts are going to depend on the outcomes, but we're not going to have them in time, so Congress will have to make its own budget decisions in a bit of a vacuum, and I think they are beginning to recognize that as a result of the hearings this week. Those of us who analyze defense and national security are still waiting, in addition, for the information that we usually get with the budget, so we can actually tell whether what the QDR says it did shows up in the budget and in the FYDP. And we'll see that hopefully over the next few days and weeks. And it'll give us the details to really be able to provide a judgment here. And then finally, there is, as most of you know, a congressionally mandated panel to review this review. Earlier this week, it was announced that that panel will be co-chaired by former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry and former National Security Advisor Steve Hadley. I would commend, and I think everyone here would commend, that that panel would, in fact, pay some attention to these industrial-based issues as it undertakes its review and reports out to the Congress in late spring and early summer. So I think that this is going to be an ongoing series of discussions. My final thing is I would like to ask you to join me in recognizing and acknowledging the CSIS staff who made this event possible this morning. I'd like them to please stand, and let's give them a round of applause, those of you here in the room. So before we go, I want to remind you about the Philippine foreign minister next door. I want to thank you for coming. I want to thank you even more for your attention and support on these issues. Have a great snowy weekend.